Good evening and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. You can find us on the internet at commonwealthclub.org. I'm Joe Epstein, a past president of the Commonwealth Club's Board of Governors and your moderator for tonight's program. It is now my pleasure to introduce our distinguished speaker, Michael Krasny, host and senior editor of KQED's Forum and author of the book Off Mic, a memoir of talk radio and literary life. We all know today's speaker, Michael Krasny, as the very erudite host of KQED's morning radio talk show Forum, and I assume that most of us know that he is also a tenured professor of English at San Francisco State University. Part of Michael Krasny's life is spent battling city traffic as he shuttles between home, the radio station, and the university. His preparation for the Forum show entails keeping a constant eye on the breaking news and trends, reading the latest novels by authors he interviews, and generally being acutely aware of what is going on in this fast-paced world that we all live in. According to KQED producer Raul Ramirez, in a week's time, Michael will absorb and discuss knowledgeably more ideas and facts than many of us will confront in 6 months' time. And despite this, Michael manages to remain remarkably approachable, sensible, and sensitive. Michael Krasny grew up in Cleveland, Ohio. His father was a worker in an ice cream factory. And his father, according to Michael, wanted nothing more for his son than a good education and a professional white-collar job. His father helped him pay for his education at Ohio University, where Michael earned a Bachelor of Arts, and he graduated cum laude, and is also a member of the Phi Beta Kappa Honor Society. He also obtained his MA from Ohio University. He received his PhD in 20th century literature from the University of Wisconsin at Madison. And one of his first radio jobs was in the late 1970s. Michael hosted a weekly Marin County talk show called Beyond the Hot Tub, which was broadcast on station KTIM. KTIM was a local low-power rock radio station. He not only interviewed the guests on his program, but he was responsible to arrange to hire the people he was interviewing, and in many cases, he had to pick them up and drive them to the station. In his book, Off Mic, he describes many of those early interviews, including the time he spent interviewing Sausalito Madam Sally Stanford. After those early years in Marin County, Michael went on to the big leagues and hosted a popular nighttime radio program on KGO AM radio, and he co-anchored the weekly KGO television show Night Focus. Then in 1993, he became the host of KQED's popular talk show Forum. Dr. Michael Krasny has interviewed many of the leading newsmakers and cultural icons of our time, including Saul Bellow, Gore Vidal, former President Jimmy Carter, Cesar Chavez, Rosa Parks, Jane Goodall, and many, many more. He lives in Marin County with his wife, Leslie, an attorney. The Krasnys have two grown daughters. So here to talk about his life, talk about his career, some of the people he has met, and to discuss his book, Off Mic, is the host of the award-winning KQED program Forum, Dr. Michael Krasny.
Thank you, Joe. And I noticed the doors were closed, so I guess you're locked in here with me for a while, but that will be pleasant, I trust. In fact, it's strange coming back to this territory because when my wife and I moved out here in 1970, and it's funny, what comes to mind here quickly is an interview that my friend Isabel Allende did with me at the Herb Theater in San Francisco when my book was published, and she said to me, he came out here to teach as a college professor in 1970, and then she paused, and somebody who has very good Chilean humor timing said, he's old. But we came out here, and we stayed in Rossmore because my in-laws knew some people who were, I guess, investors and part owners of Rossmore before it became a public place. And the thing about coming back here to this terrain is that I realize every time I'm back here that now I'm old enough to be in Rossmore, which is when I was there with my wife as a young man, you know, a young fledgling college professor, of course, I thought, boy, you know, these people are up there. Well, here I am. Also, how many know my radio program, just out of curiosity? That's very heartening. I just came from the College of San Mateo. This has been quite a mileage day, from San Francisco to College of San Mateo, because a professor at Berkeley and I are putting out a textbook with McGraw-Hill that'll be out in the fall. And we met with a bunch of professors to talk about our textbook, and they were saying that they did a poll of some 78 students, and only three of them were familiar with National Public Radio. And I thought to myself, this is not necessarily good news, but, you know, one can make of it what one wants. Most of our surveys show that we have a very broad listenership. We have a listenership that really covers a lot of demographic area, more than you might expect, and yet getting younger listeners to listen to what we like to think of as a very balanced and in-depth kind of news program that we offer, as well as the kind of talk programs that we offer, can be a challenge. I guess it's somewhat sobering to me also to realize that in writing this book that I'm here to talk to you about tonight, I've now got a textbook coming out and another book which is being sold, auctioned, whatever. I'm not even sure. That's for agents to deliver. I didn't know I was going to write a memoir. This next book that I've done is actually a book about spirituality, which is something that I know has a great deal of currency now and is one of those signifiers that the great Derrida would call a floating signifier. It's a word that's probably overused and used promiscuously. But I wanted to represent my own quest, really. And these books are tied together. That is, the book that is now completed that I suspect will be out next year. Not the textbook, another book called Spiritual Envy. And the book that I'm here to talk to you about that is now a paperback published by Stanford University Press. I didn't know I'd write a memoir because I wanted to be a novelist. And, in fact, part of my story that's told in this book is the story of an aspiring novelist and one who was really quite impelled. You know, I don't know how best to describe that except Rilke said, "My devils were my angels," and I felt these kind of urges and strong movements toward writing a novel and wanting to be a novelist and almost aching for it since I was a young man and realizing that the thing I was missing most of all probably was talent. But aside from that, it was like Terry Gross once said to me, I didn't hear those voices. You know, she also aspired at one time to write fiction, and those voices were not in me. So when I sat down to write what I thought would be a novel that was autobiographical, I wound up instead writing an autobiography and writing a memoir, which only proves perhaps that the paucity of my imagination, because I was trained as a scholar and a broadcast journalist, and therefore I was compelled somehow to write a narrative that was truthful, or at least as truthful as I could make it be. And I also wanted in this book to talk about some of the extraordinary people I've had the good fortune to interview through the years, including some of the novelists and some of the writers of fiction, because I've been a teacher of literature, lo, these many years, longer than I've been a broadcast journalist. I felt there was maybe some peril in writing a memoir, being a boy from Cleveland, because I think the last one before me to write a memoir who was a lad from Cleveland was James Fry, and you may remember that story, some of you. But he was from a wealthier neighborhood called Shaker, and he had a much more vivid imagination than I did. I wanted actually to write about my boyhood because it was a colorful boyhood. I tell people sometimes that I was a bad boy, and they look at me with sort of alarm or disbelief or cynicism, but I was, at least to the extent that I ran around with a lot of wild characters, some of whom I wanted to write about and some of whom I wanted to bring alive in fiction. And I've done that to some degree in this book, although pretty much I decided to kind of do away with the earlier material and just begin with what was a quest or an odyssey that started when I was a college student, because that was a new slate for me, and I decided I wanted to be a good boy. I wanted to stop being a bad boy and be a good boy and excel. And my life from that point forward, probably a lot less interesting and less colorful in some ways than it was during those early years of adolescent rebellion and craziness, nevertheless is something that I wanted to get down and did. But there's still enough craziness in here, and there's still enough color in here. Just like people don't seem to subscribe to the notion that I was somewhat of one of the wild boys, as Billy Joel would put it, because I'm perhaps a little bit professorial and cerebral now. There's also this sense that my students particularly have a hard time believing I was an athlete. It's sort of strange, you know, people don't necessarily accept your former avatars, your former incarnations, particularly when you have this heavy public role that I do, heavy and yet wonderful in so many ways. Quick story here is instructive and fun to tell, and I wanted to tell a lot of stories in this book, and this is a story that I didn't tell in the book. But when I went with my family to Ixtapa, Mexico, there was a guy there who I met, who I know slightly, who lived in Tiburon. And he saw me on the beach playing some badminton, and he said to me, "Gee, Krasny, you look coordinated for a pointy-headed guy, you know?" I said, "Well, it may come as a surprise to you, and it may strike you as it does some of my students beyond being plausible, but I really was an athlete. In fact, I played football. I ran track. I was a dash man and hurdler. And played football, believe it or not, with Tom Mack." Now, Tom Mack, for those of you who don't know your gridiron history, was a professional football player. He, in high school, was much smaller than he grew when he went to the University of Michigan, went on to play for the Los Angeles Rams, was, in fact, a professional all-star lineman. And he said to me, "You played with Tom Mack." And I said, "Yes, I know. Like I said, that's hard to believe, but he was an end and I was an end, and he was a blocking more right end, I was more receiving left end." So this became a kind of ad nauseum gag during the whole time I was on this vacation. He would see me at breakfast, and he would come up and he said, "Did you really play with Tom Mack?" I'd be on the beach. He said, "This guy played with Tom Mack." I'd be with friends, and he'd say, "You know, Krasny here played with Tom Mack." Okay, so that became kind of a litany, as it were. So we're checking in at the border between Mexico and Southern California, and the customs officer with a badge and the uniform and everything is looking through my things and looks up at me, and it's a woman. She says, "You didn't really play with Tom Mack, did you?" Had to be one of the best practical jokes ever played, right? Well, there are funny stories like that. That was not in my book, but stories that to some extent I told on myself because I felt, well, I wanted to, and there's a danger in that. Stendhal, the great French writer, said, when you write about yourself, you put a target on yourself, or, you know, you shouldn't necessarily put your laundry out there. But this was a book that I just felt somehow I needed to write, or I felt compelled to write. And the nice thing about it is it's a twofer, because you not only have a good deal about me, you also have a good deal about many of these people that I've interviewed, and many of these writers are portrayed in the book. I felt like I was navigating in writing this book between Scylla and Charybdis, writing on the one hand with what was a kind of self-laceration and on the other hand a self-inflation. This is a danger when you decide to write about yourself. The other danger is that you can write too much about yourself. The first review, which was probably the only... There were two negative reviews. I'll tell you about another one in a minute. But the first one that came out, which was in many ways laudatory, was by Ben Fong Torres, a name many of you know, and certainly somebody I've known for many years, and he said to me, "Michael, I'm going to say very good things about it, but I'm also going to say some critical things." And the two critical things he said were that it sounded kvetchy, which is sort of like complaining and so forth. Okay, because I said I was a failed novelist, and I complained about that. And then he also said, you know, and this is in print in the pink section of the Chronicle, he said, I think he wrote too much about himself, and I want to say, schmuck, it's a memoir, you know? But anyway. This all came out, and it came out in ways that surprised me. I mean, I told stories that some people thought, gee, you know, do you want to put these stories out there? They kind of humanize you. And I said, well, what do you suspect I am? You know, one student, in fact, came up to me at San Francisco State and said, you know, "You've been an icon to me for many years." I said, "Read my book." Because there really are, in many respects, humanizing stories in there, and stories that I tell. Well, I'll tell you, in fact, in preparation of the other bad review, which was on on Amazon.com, excuse me, I had these stories to tell, and some of them were funny. Some of them were a bit personal. Some of them were poignant, sad. They were, but I said, as I said, human stories. One of them involved a young woman, and you can't make up these kinds of stories. This happened to me in the 60s, and this book is a bit of a cultural history of the 60s as well. And you know the old aphorism, if you remember the 60s, you probably weren't there, or you didn't really live through it. But there was a young woman who I was seeing, and she was kind of, for the times, what you would expect is daring. She smoked a lot of pot. She drove a Vespa. And finally, when we consummated our relationship, I was shocked to find out, and she informed me, that this was her virginity that was lost with me. And I wrote about this because it was a very funny and diabolically funny story. No sooner did we complete this act, and remember, I was younger than my oldest daughters, that she said, my father has been really someone who's he's studying psychiatry, and he's concerned about the fact that I'm hung up on virginity, and he wants to help me and wanted to help me, and thank you. I'm going to call him now. So she does. She gets on the phone and she calls her father, and then and she says, yeah, and he's a nice guy, and you know, finally, and you don't have to worry about me anymore. And this is moving into a new era of the pill and everything, you know. And then she said, my dad wants to talk to you. I didn't want to talk to her dad. You know, I just deflowered his daughter. No desire to whatsoever. She said, come on, he's not going to bite you. Go ahead and talk to him. And so I did. And he said, I hope we meet. I said, okay. You know, fine. I said, and that's the kind of story that I was compelled to tell. I mean, just like you tell these stories, and what happens is a lot of the more private side and personal side come out. And there's that strange difference between what goes on in the public and what goes on behind the scenes when you're doing a public life kind of thing, as I've been doing, lo, these many years. Joe mentioned, for example, KTIM and my journeyman work there, and I wanted to get those stories done. I wanted to tell about interviewing Jerry Garcia when he decided to put cocaine up his nose in the middle of the interview, and my alarm thinking that we were going to be raided by the gendarmes. I wanted to tell the only story that ever impressed my younger daughter, that I went up one night to KTIM, and it's the ganja, the marijuana smell, was so strong that you could have got a contact high. And there was a, in fact, program that at the time was devoted strictly to Rastafarian type of music. And the host of that show, a guy named Doug Wendt, who's still around DJing, said to me, Mike, I want you to meet the king of reggae. This is Bob Marley. And I shook hands with Bob Marley. And my daughter, during her teenage years, which were almost as rebellious as mine, I got real cachet out of that, you know, I mean, that I couldn't have gotten under any other circumstances. And the fact that I interviewed Jerry Garcia. I also wanted to tell what I call archetypical stories. There's an archetypical story in the book, for example, about meeting Deepak Chopra for the first time and then going out with him to a public event and in inviting questions afterward that I was fielding. And a woman said, after the question and answer period ended and just a few people were lingering around, said to him in a very hostile way, you raped me. And there was that kind of breathless intake of breath and horror. And he looked at her and he said, madam, I've never seen you before in my life. And she said, I'm not talking about this life. Now, this is a Marin story, isn't it? So that's the point of it. It's what I like to call an archetypical Marin story. I have my archetypical San Francisco story, too. When Nulo Fuelin, the great Irish memoirist, was on the air with me, she told me that she went out, and she was a big-hearted, really a bleeding-heart, wonderful woman who died last year and had about $1 million in her estate, which surprised everyone. And she said to me that she went out, and somebody came up to her and asked her for spare change, and he happened to have been an African-American man, and she gave him some money, and they started talking. And she wanted to find out about him because she's a curious novelist and so forth. And all of a sudden, he said to her, because she has this thick Irish accent, he said, didn't I hear you on Krasny this morning? I said, that's my story. It's my San Francisco story, right? These are stories that needed, I felt, somehow to be needed. That is, to needed with a KN or to be melded into a work. The most exemplary story of the public and private side of things, though, was at KGO when... This goes back a ways. We had just gotten word, I was on the air live, we had just gotten the word that George H.W. Bush, the father of George W. Bush, had selected as his running mate Daniel Quayle, whom some of you may remember was known perhaps more for his misspelling of the word potato than just about anything else. And J. Danforth Quayle was then a senator of Indiana, and I had Ken Adelman on, who was an ambassador and also a nuclear negotiator, a very smart guy, and a guy who I was talking to about nuclear armaments and so forth. He helped, in fact, broker SALT I and SALT II. And this announcement came over about Quayle being selected as running mate, and I said, you know, it doesn't seem like he's that bright, even though he's a senator. And Adelman became very, almost militant, and said, you know, he's given a bad rap. He's a smart guy. He's been involved in a lot of nuclear negotiations, and he knows and understands that weaponry. And the media is making him seem always like a Dumkopf, and he's not, or a Hayseed from, you know, Hoosier, Indiana, and he's not. He's a bright guy. We go off the air. We're off the air, and this is a KGO commercial station, of course. So we're going through the commercials, and I said, you know, I'm sorry, Ken, but I've heard Quayle talk a number of times. He just seems like a dim bulb. Whereupon Edelman says, I'm not going to insult anybody here, blank you, but, you know, with the F-bomb word, right? And me being kind of a little scrappy street kid of my past and everything, I said, blank you, right back at him, right? And then we're back on the air and everything's, you know, just like it's. So there you see behind the scenes and you see, you know, the kind of private story that goes on. I also wanted to talk about commercial radio. I wanted to talk about what it was like to work for ABC and KGO all those years that I was there. I was there for off and on for a decade or more. And to tell the story of what I think has happened now that we've become a very bifurcated world as far as radio, where commercial radio now sinking, at least last I heard Citadel didn't even have a stock to make on the market in terms of their price of stock. But the commercial world getting more and more toward, and I metamorphosed through this as a broadcaster, more and more toward wanting sensation and wanting the kind of personality-driven demagoguery of the likes of Rush Limbaugh and Michael Savage and, you know, people of that ilk. I saw that transformation taking place where it became much more about entertainment and more about really, for quite a while, right-wing radio, where, you know, KGO, in fact, bought KSFO, long-standing venerable station in San Francisco, beginning of the Dial 560, and turned it into what a friend of mine who was a media critic called Zig Heil on your dial. Things changed in that whole world of radio, and I wanted to chronicle it. I really wanted to talk from the inside about what it was like because, you know, there aren't that many of us around who have been in both worlds, and I consider it a privilege and something, therefore, that I really could give testimony to. I also had a wide enough scope with this book that it became really sort of my novel. It had the scope of a novel in many ways. It became a story of a working-class kid who moved to some extent into the bourgeoisie and felt okay about it, joining up. It's a story about love and unrequited and requited and death and loss and marriage and really stories that I feel give a canvas of a life and give the nuances of a life. And what has been heartening has been so many people who have read the book and felt they identified in some way or another with the book or found memories being evoked in the book. That's what I like. I also wanted to write about teaching, which I've been committed to. In fact, in many ways, although I call myself a broadcast journalist for the work I do on the radio, I'm a teacher, I'm an educator, and that's really what I'm born to the manor to be and have been most of my adult life, a professor. I always like what W.H. Auden says about professors. They're people who talk in other people's sleep, but it's not necessarily always universally true, or people who never say the same thing twice. I like to, you know, needle my own profession to some extent, but it's been very rewarding for me. And when I started out teaching, I came to San Francisco State the year after a black student-led strike and taught black literature. And that was quite an experience and something that I wanted to write about. I wanted to write about aspiring, as I did in the 60s and 70s, to being a novelist and realizing something very different than that. Because sometimes what you think you want to be, and many of us in the 60s wanted to be artists of one sort or another, turns out to be something that surprises you. I never knew I would be a guy working in radio. I didn't even know, for that matter, that I would be a scholar. I really wanted that much to be, you know, like Hemingway living in Europe, not as an expatriate, but certainly taking in and absorbing that whole world of the continent and being the member of my own lost generation or something like that. I wanted to write about interviewing. I wanted to write about aspiration and realization and also about really that whole difference between the spoken word and the written word. So this is an ambitious book. It's my story, as I said, but it's also one that I think many of you can and will identify with. I don't mean to sound like I'm vending the book because I'm not, but the book has been out there now for a couple of years. It's now in paperback, and it's a book that I feel pleased and proud of. It also tells the story of moving into what one reviewer called the promised land of, or the canonization. He said, I canonized public radio. Well, so be it. Moving into actually the promised land is what Dan Shore, when he left CBS and went to work for PBS, called NPR. It has its faults, to be sure. Maybe some of you in your questions and comments may want to have me address some of those as best I can. I don't apologize for what we do in public radio, but I also am proud to a great degree of what we do and what we accomplish day after day. And I think we offer a real alternative now in many more ways than we ever anticipated. It's not only an alternative because of, this is not a pledge drive, by the way. It's not only an alternative because of what the mainstream media has become, which is, frankly, in many instances, very tabloidized and sensationalized. But it's also now needed perhaps more than ever because print newspapers are not having the life they once had. And certainly so many journalists, many of the journalists that I knew, respected, had great affection for, and tremendous admiration for, have left the fold, have had early buyouts, or simply have retired. And it's a changing world. I mean, it's a world now of blogs and the internet. You probably, some of you, listen to programs we've done on this subject, and it's a subject that we take very seriously. So we are providing an education and a service, and we hope enlightenment and public service in the real sense of the meaning of that word as a mission on a daily basis. And it's something that we take quite seriously. And yet, occasionally, we like to have fun as well and hope that we provide some entertainment. When I was a KGO, they used to say infotainment is what we're all about. I began to hate that word, actually. You know, some kind of hybridization between giving information and making sure that people are glued to or wedded to listening. So that, as one program director in the days that I was in commercial radio said, even if necessary, they'll bang the dashboard out of frustration and out of anger. That's what you want. That's what you want to create, is that lividness and that sense of the blood rushing and so forth. No, what we want to create are enlightened thoughts and the life of the mind and things that will make you better citizens. That's what we are all about. That's what my life has become. I give you my life in a paperback book now, at least to some extent. Thank you so much.
Our thanks to Michael Krasny, host and senior editor of KQED's Forum.
Joe, forgive me, not senior editor any longer. I pass the torch to Daniel Zoll, and I'm glad to say that onus is no longer mine.
Former senior editor of KQED's Forum and author of the book Off Mic, a memoir of talk radio and literary life. Thanks, Michael, for your comments this evening. We do have a number of questions for you. I'm going to try to make a great deal of sense out of a bunch of questions. Some of them may be somewhat chronological, which is, I guess, a clue that maybe we'll start with your life in Cleveland. I read about a person by the name of Digger. Could you tell us about Digger?
Well, as I said, I write of many things, and one of the other things I write about is friendship. And this was a guy who was my closest friend and remains so to this day. And he wasn't as much of a bad boy as I was, but he was the kind of guy who took the ACT test and said, I don't like this, and walked out. And that was it, you know, for him, for the ACT. But in those days, it was a little easier to get into state colleges. And we both managed to get into state colleges and began to take it very seriously, wanting to excel, wanting to do well, wanting to make something of ourselves. And he indeed made something of himself quite extraordinary. He's a world-famous scientist now, in fact, a geneticist and a member of the National Academy of Science, and someone who has done some innovative and amazing research in the field of plant genetics, and is a professor and also has published a great deal. We didn't know we were headed on the academic trajectory, but that's the way it turned out. One of the stories I tell in the book is when his mother, of blessed memory, looked at both of us and said, and we had both kind of taken some pride in the fact that we were on the honor roll in college and we were doing well for ourselves and everything, and she said, you know, you two were a couple of losers in high school, his mother said. And to some extent, I don't know, loser is a pretty strong word and so forth, but there was that sense in both of us. We were competing against that image and competing against each other as well, as close friends and only close friends in some ways can do. And to this day, this is a friendship that I cherish, and this is, you know, they say if you've got one or two friends that if you're in a jail in a foreign country like Turkey or something, you can call and rely upon, he's definitely one.
Well, you indicated that you were a bad boy, and I'm not quite sure how I would define bad boy, but you did also demonstrate a minute ago, or a few minutes ago, something about your temper. And I recall reading in the book about an issue with anger management.
Yeah, I said I wanted to be honest in this book. And, you know, when I'm on the air, I'm self-controlled. But when I'm off the air, it's not always the case. And I described this once recently as driving along and somebody cuts me off. This happened a couple of times in recent vintage. And I honk the horn to let the person know that what they did was something they shouldn't have done. And they wind up flipping me off. And every cell in me wants to go after them. And you don't do that, you know, especially at my age. I'm getting, you know, a little bit long in the tooth here. But it's a kind of boyish, instinctual machismo or something that still is residual or vestigial or however you want to describe it. And I wanted to get that down. I thought it was important because I don't think it's all boys that feel this way. I think that a lot of people feel this way, particularly when they're made to feel they've been wronged. And I think a lot of us feel rage at social injustices, and a lot of us feel rage at what's done to the environment, and a lot of us feel rage and anger at the helplessness we feel in the face or in the wake of many of the daily crises that we face that are just in our newspapers or that come across my desk constantly. And I wanted to capture some of that, and I thought it was important to capture some of that. You know, it's funny, in fact, I mentioned the interview I did with Isabel Allende, and I said, you know, I'd rather be in instances like that when I feel my, what D.H. Lawrence called speaking with one's blood, I'd rather be a good Buddhist. And she said, oh, how boring, you know. But there is that sense of wanting to be a good person, which means self-control and means taking or resting control of one's impulses. And I thought that was important to write about.
Well, two of the things you did to work with your own anger management issue was to do a lot of Buddhist readings, and you also attended therapy. Could you tell us if you still utilize the learnings, the teachings of both of those things in your everyday life today to help yourself?
Well, psychotherapy has been a mixed bag for me. I've done some of it. I like to say when people say, well, why are you still so driven? I say it serves my neurosis, but I have, you know, had this low these many years. It's the thing one carries, as Tim O'Brien would say, for those of you who know that great Vietnam War story. There's a sense that it has helped in some ways, though, and that learning about Buddhist practice has helped as well, and learning some meditation techniques have certainly helped me to be more at ease about myself, or less with that kind of edge. Part of it's aging as well, I'm sure. This last book that I just finished, though, has to do with that quest, because I found myself reading in every major religion, reading, wanting to, after interviewing a lot of religious leaders and also interviewing people like Christopher Hitchens and Sam Harris and Richard Dawkins, who are kind of, to me, almost fundamentalist atheists, I wanted to write something that was more balanced, that said some things that I felt needed to be said in that were positive about religion, because I do think there are many things to be. I mean, let's forget about all the Crusades and Inquisition, you know, all the carnage and fundamentalism that is with us. But put that aside, if it hadn't been for religion, we wouldn't have had in the United States, for example, abolition movement. We wouldn't have had a civil rights movement. We would have had these social justice movements anyway, but I doubt it. I'm fairly sure we wouldn't have had an anti-war movement, Vietnam War particularly. And so, and many people live moral and righteous lives because religion serves as a guide to them. And I wanted to be a voice for that. But I also wanted to talk about my own doubts and my own skepticism and my own intellectual battling with wanting to feel something more transcendent and of a higher nature. You know what this boils down to? Garrison Keillor once, I thought it was Garrison Keillor who came up with this, and then I did some research and found out it was actually Mort Saul, I found myself writing about agnostics, and I guess it was Mort Saul who said originally, a family of agnostics moved in a neighborhood and somebody burned a question mark on their lawn, which is a great line. But there was a desire, at least, to write about doubt and agnosticism and to define it and to come to grips with it. And yet to also talk about this own odyssey of mine to try to find out what it meant to be a good man or a good person. It's still an ongoing work in progress.
There are many wonderful passages in the book. My favorite, and I think it shows your growth as an individual, was when you talked about your wife Leslie's first pregnancy. And you said, let me read this, Leslie and I got pregnant. This was, to quote you, as a time of expanded identity for yourself, I feel. How did this period affect your growth as an academic, your sense of being Jewish, or your Jewishness, I think, as you say in the book, and as you also quote, again, D.H. Lawrence, your masculinity or the hidden lady in me. I read that over and over again to make sure that I understood it, and I just loved it.
Thank you, because a lot of the guys from my old neighborhood gave me some razzing about that who read my book. They said, what is this, you know, my wife and I got pregnant, you know, that it started with that phrasing. What's the matter, Krasny? You lose your, you lose something that you used to carry around with you? Well, but the fact of the matter is I was influenced not only by having a child, as I think anybody can speak to who becomes a father or mother. It was transformative. But also by feminism and by an awakening to the fact that it was okay to be, well, androgynous is probably too strong a word to use. Maybe hermaphroditic? No. That it was okay to be a blend of masculinity and femininity. That in fact, it was kind of in at the time to be a sensitive male, or at least to present oneself as, or present to oneself being a sensitive male. And I think those two things kind of combined in that period. That is, being a father and being more acutely aware of the allowance that I was making for something more soft and sensitive that was inside of me that didn't have to have a hard edge to it. And it was transformative.
Well, I'd like to switch gears just a little bit to some specific questions on your career in the radio. But before I do, I want to remind everyone that you are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program. We're talking with Michael Krasny, host and former senior editor of KQED's Forum and author of the book Off Mic, A Memoir of Talk Radio and Literary Life.
It was a good station ID, Joe. That's
Thank you very much, Michael. So what's it like sitting on the other side of the table? As someone who knows the art of interviewing as well as anyone, what is it like to be on the other side of that table during an interview? What have you learned as an interviewee that may have helped you in your own technique in your job as a radio host?
Well, it's been fun. It's been certainly also educational seeing how other people interview, although I've always been to some extent an observer of the craft or the art or whatever you like to call it. But it's also kind of conforms with some of my own theories about interviewing. In the book, I write about a continuum of interviewing. There's a kind of interviewer who Jim Lehrer once said to me, for example, I told him about an interview that I did where nobody remembered that I was the interviewer, and he said, that's the kind of interviewer you want to be, right? Then there's the other side of it, you know, I don't know, maybe Charlie Rose, you know, an interviewer who brings himself into it in a very strong way and makes his or her presence known and becomes sort of part of the old exchange as a personality. I really felt I wanted to be somewhere in between those two. I mean, because I realize that my strong suit may be bringing people out and listening, but I also have things to say, and as an educator, that's a weakness, wanting to say things and prepping a lot. And so I wanted to bring both things to the process and generally try to do that. But it was fascinating seeing other people work spontaneously, work from notes, work. We all do it differently, and we all kind of have different kind of stylistics and techniques, it seems to me. But I still think this continuum holds true. And it holds true, I've discovered, about conversation, too. Because if you listen to the way people speak to each other, some people, you know, really like to hold forth. Other people really enjoy much more listening and being sounding boards. And then there are those who work it in between or feel more comfortable in that in-between area. There's a whole kind of rhythm to an interview as there is to a conversation. There's a pattern to it. There's a cadence to it. And you become quite conscious of it when you're on the other end in ways that you're not when you're doing it. I can tell you that from the experiences I've had on the other end.
And you also recently interviewed, I think it was the first part of this year, Glenn Ifill. And I think part of your discussion might have dealt with this technique of an interviewer. Should you be out there? Should you be, as Jim Lehrer does say, should you be invisible?
Well, Gwen is sort of with me on that, I discovered. And certainly you can see it watching her, although Jim Lehrer is her boss, and to some extent I think she, in her TV show, she's more interactive. She's more herself and likes to expose to some extent her own views and opinions in a modified way than she does on the NewsHour, because the NewsHour operates under this assumption that the broadcast journalist, the interviewer, is to some extent someone who is as objective as one can be in that situation. By the way, in journalism, any kind of journalism, it's very difficult to be objective. It's almost a word that one realizes just in using language doesn't exist to any of the absolute degree that many people hope it does or think or like to idealize the fact that it is. So I would say that she's more kind of, as opposed to Jim Lehrer, who does that kind of interviewing. In fact, I nailed him on it one time. I said to him, well, you got pretty upset once when you were talking about Bosnia and you were... and he said, that's the one time I let it out. You know, I just happened to hear this. It was just my good luck of driving along in my car, and there was that particular interview, and I mentioned it on the air in an interview I did with him. The thing about interviewing Jim Lehrer, he's on another book tour. He writes almost a novel a year. It's amazing how he does it. And he says it's like having a fever. It just has to be done. And I admire that, you know, because as I said, I wanted to be a novelist. But I really had to go through agonizing. Did I want to have Jim on because I have to read another one of Jim's novels? No offense to Jim, but, you know, I like other novelists more than I like Jim Lehrer. I'll admit that publicly. He's a brilliant broadcaster and organizer of the Lehrer News Report, father of it now that Robert McNeil's gone. But as a novelist, it's up and down.
Well, Michael, you've worked on in both the private or for-profit radio and for public radio. One of the audience members has submitted a question here and wants to know what the main differences are between commercial radio, for example, KGO, and NPR, besides the advertising.
Well, it's ratings, largely, because and a lot of people think that the commercial radio conspires to advance right-wing causes or corporate causes, depending on who they're owned by and all that. I found less of that than I did just concern about what the ratings were going to be. And the rating, you know, it's a strange thing when you think about it, selling air, but that's what they do. We have underwriting, which is a form, of, one could say, of advertising, a kind of modified, euphemistic advertising. But nevertheless, they have to have the ratings, and they live and die by the ratings. And so they have theories about what creates ratings, and they have a whole culture that's very different than the culture of public broadcasting. And public broadcasting is not driven by ratings. I mean, we have to obviously have an audience. There was a show some of you may remember called Pacific Time, which was, I thought in many ways, a terrific show, and changed the host, changed. Gut Dinh Duc was a Vietnamese poet and broadcaster, left, and his place was taken by a San Jose Mercury News woman reporter, and the show just really couldn't garner the audience, and as a result, with cutbacks, it went under, which is too bad. I mean, it was all about Asian culture and Asia and Asian Americans. You would have thought it would have done better, particularly in terms of getting underwriting, but the sad fact is it didn't. But we don't live and die by that. I mean, and commercial radio does, and consequently, they keep ramping it up. They keep making it more and more ratcheting up in terms of what's controversial, what's going to bring in younger demographics. When I was there, that was the mantra that I heard over and over again, younger demos. You got to get the younger demos. And they had, nobody really knows what's going to bring younger people in to listen to a radio program. If they're informed and they're interested in being informed, they'll listen to my program, I like to think. If they're interested in listening to entertainment, maybe they'll find their way to Rush Limbaugh or Ron Owens, who also does actually a quality informative program and happens to be a friend of mine. There is nevertheless an obsessiveness about ratings and being first to get a news story and being first to be most controversial. And I mean, I tell stories, for example, about when I was at KGO and the then program director, who was recently fired, who was probably more single-handedly involved in my leaving than anybody else, Nothing has to do with one another. He was fired many years later. But he used to say to me, well, here's an example of what I'm talking about. It's a kind of metaphor. I have these metaphors about the differences between commercial radio and public radio. One is when he said to me after I had on the great doyen Jessica Mitford, you know, who wrote America's Way of Death and all about funerals and so forth and the funeral business. I had her on one week with Doris Lessing, Nobel laureate. I was very proud to have both those women on, admirer of both of them. It came up to me, this is a guy who became an executive. I said kind of a combination of the Peter Principle and the Dilbert Principle. Came up to me and he said, Kraz, which is what he called me. He said, Kraz, you got to stop having these old broads on. We're not going to get the younger demos. You know, and he was, you know, serious and sincere about it. We're on Sirius XM now, which was formerly Sirius, you know, an non-terrestrial satellite radio that goes all over the world. It's kind of fun to get, you know, emails that say, I couldn't get I was trying to listen to you on my iPod, and I was walking along the Helsinki River, and it didn't come in so well. You know, kind of what McLuhan said, we're a global village now. But here I was signing up for our program, Forum, to be on Sirius, which is now Sirius XM, because they are one company now. And around the same time that I signed the contract, there was talk about Howard Stern going over to Sirius, which he ultimately did 5 years later. And by that point, I'd been on 5 years, and I had not received any compensation for being on Sirius. Howard Stern, as some of you know, signed a $500 million contract to be on 5 years on Sirius. So that was kind of a yardstick for me. There were a few more, but... well, I like to say, old boilerplate line of mine is that people say, Larry King, as an interviewer, you're asking about interviewing Joe. And I said, Larry King takes pride in the fact, and this is not in any way to slam Larry King, but he does, many of you know, he takes pride in the fact he never reads a book of a guest that he has on. So, you know, he started, so tell me about this book, and I want you to give it the title, and, you know, that's right. Still got that Brooklyn boy in him. Well, you know, my rap is, and to some extent it's true, that I always read the book, or at least some of it, or a good deal of it. And my quip is, that's why Larry King's rich and famous, and I'm not. That's true. There's the difference.
Well, that's a great segue to these two questions, which I'll combine, Michael. How do you cover so many books so quickly? And it seems from one day to the next, you read two entire books, and the questioner goes on to say, do you have good support? Are the questions rehearsed?
I wish I could say yes, because there are times when I feel so obligated by my own work ethic that I would like to have questions written out or rehearsed. In fact, early on in my broadcasting career, I was sort of insulted because publicists, I realized, would give you a sheet, and they'd say, you can ask the guest questions in the order they're on the sheet. And I thought, what fun is that, you know? I mean, to me, the fun, the excitement, the challenge is becoming knowledgeable and then being able to talk knowledgeably and have a conversation that really is enlightening or illuminating. And that's really how I've always tried to do it as far as my own professionalism is concerned and how I can't help but do it. I do have wonderful people who work with me. Mainly they feed me. I'm like a black hole. I mean, they'll give me links. They'll give me articles. They do a lot of searching for material. But I absorb it, and I absorb it because I work a lot. There's no hiding the fact. If you listen to the program, you probably know that I do a lot of prepping. Too much, in fact, probably. There used to be an old saw that you should prep maybe 2 hours for every hour you're on the air. And I put in a lot more time than that because I read a lot, as you indicate. And I spend, you know, some people have businesses that are open 7 days a week. I'm reading 7 days a week. And I'm not doing a number of things that perhaps I would be doing otherwise that those of you who live normal lives are doing. I mean, I'm not learning how to cook, or I'm not, you know, going on toward my black belt in karate, or I'm not, you know, golfing or out there working in the garden, or, you know, all of these kinds of things that are wonderful and give one a sense to savor and abundant. I have a pretty active social life and cultural life for the most part, but nevertheless, a lot of time is spent reading, and that's the life I've chosen. And you know what it's done for me? It's made me realize how bloody ignorant I am. I mean, the more knowledge that you amass, the more you learn, the more you realize how little, infinitesimally, you really know. And since I'm blessed or cursed with being curious about almost everything, and like the idea of being conversant on a whole range of different subjects, that's what I do.
Well, I'd like to ask you about what you define as the zone. Radio and TV personalities, athletes, and others in the public eye often speak of being in the zone or being on their game. What can you tell us about this? Can you recall some of the times that you were really in the zone?
Well, I write about that in my teaching at one point, and I write about it in terms of inflation and deflation in the book. I write about actually teaching a poem by Wallace Stevens Sunday morning, which some of you may know, and feeling while I was teaching it about as close as you can get. I remember almost ontologically, you know, with my being thinking, this is as good as teaching gets. This is a high beyond reason, because things were coming out of me. I was figuring and seeing things that I hadn't seen before, that I hadn't even thought of before in the poem, and just talking about it, getting more and more excited, and then suddenly paused and said, are there any questions? And because people were looking rapt, you know, I was pretty wrapped up in what I was doing and feeling in that zone. And a hand comes up in the front, and I said, yes. And the young woman said, about that paper that's due next week. I mean, this is the inflation followed by the deflation. I mean, actually, one that many here can appreciate, when I first started going out and appearing publicly with this book of mine, I went to a bookstore in Palo Alto, and a woman came up to me, and she said, Dr. Krasny, you are my professor, and I've been waiting 30 years to thank you for inspiring me to become a teacher. Because of you, I became a teacher as well. And I said, that makes me feel wonderful, and thank you so much for saying that. Where do you teach? And she said, oh, I retired 2 years ago. You know, so there, the inflation and the deflation followed by... There's really, it's a kind of ineffable thing, that zone. I mean, if you're there, you know it. For those of you who have participated in athletics and been very intense or passionate about it, or if you've been performing at something that really gives you a high, whatever the performance might be, public performance, even a private performance in the bedroom sometimes, you know, you can feel that you're in a level that you haven't reached before. It's like the mind and the body come together, and it does create a sense of almost elevation. And it's joyful, really. It's something that you should savor, and you try to savor as much as you can. There are sporadic moments that come on you like that, sometimes by surprise, and that's when they're most welcome. But they can come on you just by simply doing what you do and realizing that what you're doing is making an effect on you and on others.
Well, we'll get off this abstract line of questioning in just a moment after I ask you just one more. You have said that radio is the theater of the mind. What did you mean by this comment?
Well, there are no pictures. The pictures have to be made in the mind. When MTV came on, I thought to myself, is this a good thing for music to be pictured in ways that images are created, and now they're supplanting the images that we create in our head that the music has for us? And radio has always offered that. It's why I became enchanted and enamored of it at a very young age. I mean, I was in the TV age, the dawn of the TV age as a young boy, and we were very excited. I remember going seeing Rudy Kazudi for the first time in my neighbor's television set, a little thing about, you know, maybe 8 inches or something like that, RCA Victor. There's a sense that we can communicate in radio and make pictures in your mind. One of the challenging things for me to do, for example, through the years has been talk about photography on the air or talk about painting on the air. You know, how do we make those kinds of subjects visual? And blind people who listen to the radio a great deal will tell you that it's a tremendous boon to them. I mean, some of the more moving and poignant public appearances I've had have been among the blind, because we offer them what our visual age can't offer, and we offer people a medium that the visual age can't even approximate. And on public radio, we can go in depth in ways that simply can't be done. I'll have someone on and they'll say, you know, an hour. This is such a luxury to talk for an hour on the air with just one break, as opposed to doing, you know, one of these maybe 60-second, 180 seconds on television. And there's a vast difference between what was called the wasteland of television early on in its days and what I believe radio has offered and continues to offer.
Well, before we go on to a series of questions about some of the...
But, excuse me, Joe, I don't want to put down public television when I say that, by the way. I'm just talking about what one sees in a normal day on all those channels, all those many, many channels.
Right. So I want to move to some questions about some of your most memorable interviews. But before I do that, I do want to remind our audience that you're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program, and we're talking with Dr. Michael Krasny, host of KQED's Forum and author of the book Off Mic, A Memoir of Talk Radio and Literary Life. Michael, I would like to frame, if I may, or begin the list of several people whose interviews you have done and which I enjoyed reading about tremendously with the following questions. Who was your most difficult interview? Who was your most surprising interview? And who was your most inspiring interview? And I'd like to start with the interview that you basically start with in your book, Saul Bellow.
Well, not it doesn't fit any of those categories, but it was a strange meeting of fate, kismet, destiny, call it what you will, that when I was a senior in college, I decided to do an honors project on Saul Bellow, and I became very excited by his work, and I felt I had to meet him. And there was a kid in my dorm who knew his son, and I wrote a letter. He was at the time at the University of Chicago, and I was in Southern Ohio, and I wrote a letter to him, care of the University of Chicago Department of Social Thought, which is where he taught. And I got a card back that said, Mr. Bellow is in his office at such and such an hour, and I thought, wow, that's it. That's all I needed, you know. So I went to hitchhike to Chicago and went to Bellow's office, middle winter, and he was there, but didn't anticipate me or hadn't been informed about me. In fact, this was a kind of pro forma response, now I understand, that said these are his office hours if you want to see him. Well, he was actually quite cordial to me, and it was, you know, it's really something when you meet your idol, because that's really what it was. I mean, those of you who have had this kind of experience, we were in thinking of doing a forum program on something along these lines, you know, what's it like to meet somebody? Everybody's got a story about meeting somebody really famous. Some of them not such pretty stories, by the way. My mother used to say, that Yul Brynner, I admired him so much, and then he wouldn't. Anyway. So Bellow was cordial to me. I interviewed him, and I had no idea that years later, you know, I would be interviewing all of these extraordinary writers and outstanding writers, and that it would be part of my career, an important part of my career, obviously. I had no idea at the time, and yet in some ways it almost now, as I look back on it, seems it's kind of faded. So I write about it in the book, the Bellow interview, yeah.
Gorby Dahl, he's been referred to as a precocious talent. In your book, Off Mic, you describe your early career interview with him and your surprise, almost shock, at his condescending manner and his anti-Semitism.
Yeah, that's an accurate description. I was surprised at Vidal. I was all prepared. It was the first interview I did after Bellow. I was asked to do an interview by public radio for public radio, public television, excuse me, by a friend who was on the board and got to interview some writers, and that's how things started before I went to Marin County and KTIM or KGO. And Vidal was someone who I admired more, mainly as an essayist, more than as a novelist. I'm sounding like a snob here in my novel taste, you know. Bellow is great, but Lehrer and Vidal, and anyway. But, you know, taste is something I tell my students is important. Anyway, I didn't know what it would be like to interview Gore Vidal, but I was prepared to like him. A literary guy, brilliant guy, sarcastic, caustic wit. You know, he had many traits that I really liked. Used to go on the Johnny Carson show, you know, and watch him and think, boy, wouldn't it be fun to talk to him? And here I had an opportunity to talk to him. You know, this was like out of the blue. Well, he was intoxicated, as I write in my book, and was nasty and was making cracks about Jews. I don't know if he knew I was Jewish, but They certainly were not welcome, and I was not happy about it. And yet I felt I had to do a professional job and interview him. That's what I was there for. And it was an extraordinary transformation, because once the camera went on and once the lights were on and we were on, he was acting like he was, I said, afflicted with terminal Weltschmerz was the phrase I used. You know, Weltschmerz is like world weariness, you know, when before we were on there, and this drunkenness and this sloshing around and caustic nastiness and everything. Once we were on the air, he was alive in a way that just was unbelievable. And he was very responsive to what I was saying, but he was also going to great lengths to try to kind of jab at me for being an English professor. You know, he said, all you English professors, you know, you're all the same. All you want to do is write the annotation of Finnegan's Wake that nobody but other English professors want to read, you know, and these kind of comments. And so I felt, boy, you know, this guy's after my profession, my tribe, you know. And I call it a kind of baptism of fire. It's a funny word to use for a Jew, but that's what I felt it was in some ways. It was a not-so-pleasant experience. And I thought, is this something I really want to do? Do I want to interview people and deal with people like Vidal? Well, you know, I have some of those stories. They're in the book. It's not all, you know, been wonderful and enchanting and interviews that stay in one's memory and that one remembers with delight or happiness. There have been some tough moments and some people who were downright difficult. And not necessarily difficult for others to interview. Richard Ford, I write about, the novelist who I had a very difficult time with and seemed to me to be just motivelessly malignant, to use a phrase that's used about Melville's character. I'm getting into my literary hat here. In Benito Cereno, Billy Budd. Anyway, I didn't like Richard Ford, but I know somebody who interviewed him who thought he was a great guy. I mean, this is the way sometimes it's chemistry with somebody. They're in a bad mood. Something happens. Usually people come in and they're on their best behavior. And the reason for that is very simple. They're trying to make a good impression. They're trying to sell a book or an idea or a political platform or whatever it is. And they're being public. And they can be, you know, rotten, dirty scoundrels. But when they put on the public personality, it's a different personality. But there have been, you know, some horror stories, and I tell them in the book.
My favorite passage on an interview was with Cynthia Ozick. Is that the correct way to pronounce
yes.
it? Cynthia Ozick. She has a view of the world as being unkind. Can you talk a little bit more about that and about her?
Cynthia Ozick is a brilliant writer, happens to be Jewish, and who was going to high school in the Bronx during the Holocaust and became very mindful of what was going on to Anne Frank, to, you know, Jews being put in ovens and under Zyklon B and all of that, attempt to exterminate a whole people, genocide. And she kind of absorbed that whole experience and said, why should I be here in the United States free of all of this sort of horror that's going on with people who were born into the same peoplehood that I have been born into. And I think it shaped her life. And I tried to write about interviewing her. There were some very hot moments on the air with her, because she's also a very strong supporter of the State of Israel. And at the time, there was a lot of angry young people, both Jews and non-Jews, like there is now with Gaza, about Israel and the occupation, and they were expressing themselves, including some young Jewish people who had gone to Israel to act as shields for Palestinians from the Israeli army. And Cynthia Ozick, as you can imagine, got very angry at them and expressed herself. And it's a pretty, I think, lively portrait that I try to give of her, because I was very taken with her and have been a long admirer of her art as well as her brain. She's a very smart woman and a woman whom I admire a great deal.
Well, unfortunately, we've reached the point in the program where there is time for only one last question. I had several questions submitted about some global issues. This one happens to be about Afghanistan. You recently hosted a panel which included Soraya Sahadi Nelson, NPR's Afghanistan bureau chief, discussing the impact of the surge in Afghanistan. What was your takeaway, Michael, from that program?
Well, I learned more, as I do when I have experts on, but I honestly went into that program thinking this is an unwinnable war for the United States, even with a surge. I mean, you could say Iraq, the surge helped, but it helped also to pay off a lot of the insurgents and really buy them off. And just time and a tipping point and the establishment of the Shiite government. I think things are still very shaky there under Shiite rule in Iraq. But Afghanistan has been a constant horror show. It was for the USSR, the old Soviet Union. It was for the Brits. I mean, just read Kipling. And it's always been a no-win situation. And as much as I respect Obama's desire to keep Afghanistan from being the kind of state that maybe Somalia is turning into, that is a haven for al-Qaeda and terrorists, I don't know that I don't know what we can accomplish there. I think we need presence there, we meaning obviously the United States, but to put more and more manpower in. Well, before I did that show, I had the chief of Armed Forces on, Admiral Mullen, and even he sees it this way. He says, what we're going to do in Afghanistan is we need to somehow do something about the narcotics trade because a lot of that money is going to al-Qaeda across the border to Pakistan, if not in Afghanistan itself. We have to do something about not only the economy but about the terrible situation both politically and personally for people, especially women in Afghanistan, and we're not doing enough. And the fact of the matter is, it's not going to be done, I don't think, by soldiering. It's not going to be done by more occupation. It's going to be done by slow process of not necessarily nation building. I know that has a bad pejorative association with it, but putting some resources into it. And we're putting a lot of resources into stimulus packages, and we're putting a lot of money into foreign aid. It's true. But this is a terribly volatile part of the world, and this is a part of the world that we have to keep from being occupied by the Taliban, because the Taliban still continue to have strong ties to al-Qaeda, and there is an alliance between the Taliban and al-Qaeda that continues and that is very dangerous for the West and particularly for the United States. I believe that, and that's where I think President Obama is right in wanting to make it not a sanctuary for al-Qaeda. But I don't know that a surge and constant replenishment with more and more troops is what we need. I think we need a presence there, but I'm convinced, especially after that particular program, that we may not need the presence that this Obama administration thinks we need.
Well, Michael, it's been a real pleasure for me, and I know for the audience. Our thanks to Dr. Michael Krasny, host of KQED's Forum and author of the book Off Mic, a memoir of talk radio and literary life. Michael, thank you for your comments. We also thank our audiences here and on the radio. My name's Joe Epstein. And now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, celebrating more than a century of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.
Thank you. Thank you, sir.